Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Anthony Lewis today, Madeleine Albright, and something that's very special to me, and I hope will be special to some of you too. The tennis great and humanitarian Arthur Ashe once called into the show. It was on Martin Luther King Day in 1993 to compare Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, which was our topic at the moment. We will re-air that phone call today as we present a copy of the call to Ashe's widow, who has launched an Arthur Ashe legacy website. This is going to give you chills, I guarantee, as you hear it. Arthur Ashe's call into this show from 1993 and Jeannie Ashe coming up next hour. And we thank all of you who contributed to our winter membership drive during Morning Edition and the BBC World Service today. And we hope those of you who have not yet contributed this year, and this is our first membership drive of the year, we'll call in or log on sometime today. I'm not going to dwell on it now as we're going to bring Anthony Lewis right up, but it's 1-888-376-WNYC. Thank you for calling 1-888-376-9692 or for going to WNYC.org to support the station. Thanks a lot, everybody, for making this all possible. And yes, Anthony Lewis is with us. He was a New York Times columnist for 32 years, from 1969 to 2001. At the age of 80, he is still writing about his core issues of freedom and civil liberties and torture, and he has a new book called Freedom for the Thought That We Hate, a biography of the First Amendment. If you know Anthony Lewis's work, some of his positions in this book will reinforce what you think of him, and some will probably surprise you. Anthony, it's great to have you back on WNYC. Good morning.
Thanks. It's nice to be here.
Before we even get into the history of some current issues, to the history of the First Amendment or some current issues in the news, can you tell us why you've dedicated so much of your work to First Amendment issues? What, maybe it's obvious, but what makes it so meaningful and so important?
I think the idea of the freedom of expression clauses of the First Amendment, free speech and freedom of the press, is central to our form of government. James Madison said we had a unique system in which the people were the ultimate sovereigns. That was a new idea when it was started, and it would only work if the sovereigns, that is us, were informed about what was going on and could hold the government accountable. That's very simple. Without information, we couldn't do the job of a citizen.
So even though it's in the Constitution, you tell us in the book that the First Amendment, as we know it, is really a creation of the 20th century, just of the last 75 or 80 years. How so?
That's true. That's true in the sense of being legally enforceable, being able to go into a court and say, you can't stop me from speaking. You can't shut my newspaper down. Before that, it was an ideal, but which could only be enforced by protest or politics. As, for example, when in 1798, Congress passed a Sedition Act that made it a crime to criticize the president. Nobody went to court over it, but Madison and Jefferson fought against it politically and won when Jefferson was elected president in 1800. But it was only 140 years after the amendment was added to the Constitution in 1931 that the Supreme Court first enforced the amendment in favor of somebody who was claiming a right to speak.
And so you say the First Amendment as we know it today is really a creation of the courts?
Absolutely. Well said.
Activist judges. That's a controversial idea these days.
Well, you know, activist judges, activism is a phrase which really means I don't like the decision. Because when somebody decides something that you like, people don't call it activist. I'd say creative judges, taking the 14 words of the First Amendment, Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press, and understand that they mean something very serious. You can't put a newspaper out of business. You can't keep the New York Times from publishing the Pentagon Papers. Courts have to decide whether those rather grand words apply to particular facts. And they're always closely fought issues. The government said in the Pentagon Papers case, if you let the Times publish this, why, the country will fall apart. National security will be creamed. The Supreme Court didn't believe that.
And you seem to draw this history as being on pretty much a straight upward trajectory, not completely straight, but for the most part, since that decision in 1931. Do you think that we're living in the heyday of the First Amendment in this country today, even after the pressures that have come to bear since 9/11?
I think the First Amendment is in very good shape, and I think it's Americans are freer to say what they want, to criticize the president. Now, there are other things going on that we can't be very happy about as civil, if we're civil libertarians or if we care about the Constitution. For example, the torture of prisoners. I never thought I'd live to see an American government dedicated to torturing prisoners. The holding of people indefinitely as detainees with no opportunity to challenge the reason for their detention. Those things are very serious, but they're not freedom of expression issues.
Let me ask you something about torture, because it's in the news right now, as you know, in a number of ways, and this is outside of the scope of your book, but do you think the military tribunals just announced for those 9/11 suspects will be hampered by allegations of evidence obtained through torture? Can it come up?
Oh, yes. Counsel for the defense, counsel for the accused detainees will surely bring it up. The rules of the tribunals imposed or created by the Bush administration essentially make it impossible for the judges, that is, the military officers, to exclude evidence obtained by torture. That's the idea. But whether that will survive all the challenges, we will find out, but probably not for years from now, because it's a very slow process.
So you think there will be battles in what would amount to open court, open tribunal, about...
They're not very open, because some of the evidence may be taken in secret, and the defendant's not allowed to know what the evidence is. It's a rather cloudy picture, which we'll have to wait and see what actually happens. But it's not going to be the openness of an ordinary trial, certainly not. The government has resisted that from day one.
So you don't think we're going to see debate in court that the public will be able to witness about what interrogation techniques were used and whether they were legitimate?
I think the government will do everything in its power to keep the reality of those interrogation techniques secret. That's been the rule ever since it started. The government has blacked out any reference to interrogation techniques, which is to say extreme stress or waterboarding or rooms that are heated to a boiling temperature or shrieking sound 24 hours a day, all the other things they've done. They've refused to let any of that come out unless it accidentally comes out, as at Abu Ghraib.
Mm-hmm. Anthony Lewis is my guest, the former New York Times columnist, author now of Freedom for the Thought That We Hate, a biography of the First Amendment. One other thing on those trials, since you write in the book about fear as a tactic in politics to chill free speech, what about as a campaign tool? Is it too cynical to think that the timing of these 9/11 trials might be coming now just as the presidential campaign is getting underway, by a matter of design?
I don't think it's too cynical. I don't know whether it is or not. No one can be sure. None of us on the outside of the government can be sure. But it is a fact that, you know, the New York Times said a day or two ago that the main theme of the Republican candidate for the presidency, when that candidate is finally chosen, probably John McCain, is going to be, I'm better on national security. I can keep the terrorists at bay. I'm not going to be soft on terrorism. Mitt Romney said that in his resignation speech, amazingly McCarthy-like statement. I'm getting out so that we'll have a better chance of defeating these weak on terrorism Democrats.
You say McCarthy-like?
Oh, I thought Romney's speech was right off the Joe McCarthy page. Yes, absolutely.
Go a little
more.
Tarring
the Democrats as a soft on terrorism. That sounds like old Joe.
Now, despite your advocacy for freedom of speech and of the press, you criticize the press in this book for being too intrusive sometimes, for not leaving people alone. What's that about?
Well, I don't think it's a great secret that sometimes the tabloid press in this country, or particularly in Britain, where I lived for a while and which has the world's most powerful agglomeration of tabloid press, and that they shove microphones at people who are grieving losses, that they intrude on private life in very nasty ways. We all know that. The question is whether anything can be done about it. The First Amendment is very broad in this country, and the courts are not going to allow us to stop the tabloid press from being what it is. But occasionally, it goes too far, and then the victim can recover modest damages.
And you criticize, also to some degree on privacy grounds, some of the effects of modern communication, like text messaging and the Internet. You write some negative things about Facebook. Are you a Luddite?
I guess I'm something of a Luddite, but I don't – when you say I criticize Facebook, I rather say that I'm stunned by it. I can't understand young people who want to let all the secrets of their private life hang out on a public medium. That just seems to me to be amazing, because most of us value not secrecy so much as a degree of privacy about our innermost thoughts. We all have thoughts that are unworthy, that are sexy, that are angry. You know, that's the way people are made, and we don't want to parade them. I thought people didn't want to parade them out in public, but apparently young people do.
Well, only the ones they choose to write on Facebook. But do you think our relationship to privacy as a culture, not just within the realm of the law, is changing, and is that threatening in any way?
I wouldn't call it threatening. I say it's a change in the culture. Yes, there is a change in the culture. We have a culture of, to a degree, of letting it all hang out, and certainly of vulgarity of a kind that never existed when I was a child. I want to tell you that I'm not in favor of censorship. I think when the FCC, for example, the Federal Communications Commission, decides to be the national nanny and punish networks for an accidental display of Janet Jackson's wardrobe malfunction, it's ridiculous. But I simply say that I prefer a quieter culture. Maybe that makes me a Luddite.
We just have a couple of minutes left with Anthony Lewis, former New York Times columnist, author now of Freedom for the Thought That We Hate, a biography of the First Amendment. One other quick thing on the Internet. Isn't it one of the most powerful engines of free speech in human history?
It is indeed. And the interesting thing is that when James Madison drafted the First Amendment in 1791, he was dealing with a multitude of little papers that took almost no money to publish. You just brought your fool's cap to a printer and said, here's my newspaper, print it. And he believed in that, even though he was often criticized and he didn't love the criticism. He said the right answer is to have other people speak, more speech. Mm. We're now living in a kind of technological Madisonian universe in which anybody can speak. And that speech can be carried on the web. It's quite wonderful.
You know, critics of the McCain-Feingold campaign finance law call that a restriction on the First Amendment. What's your opinion about that?
I agreed when the Supreme Court first decided that campaign spending was a form of speech. I agreed with my constitutional law professor, Paul Freund, who said, they say that money talks. I thought that was the problem, not the solution.
Anthony Lewis, his new book, Freedom for the Thought That We Hate, a biography of the First Amendment. Always great to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Madeline Albright, my next guest. Stay tuned.